Our next speaker is a graduate of Carnegie Tech, graduated in 1942 with a Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical Engineering. He served in World War II in the U.S. Signal Corps. And after his service in World War II, he joined the Westinghouse Electric Corporation as a design engineer. This was followed by a number of assignments and subsequently was promoted to Manager of Application Engineering. In 1952, he was transferred to the newly formed Atomic Equipment Division of Westinghouse, and for the next 12 years served as Manager of Marketing for that division. In his current assignment, Mr. Hauser is responsible for the technical, economic, and environmental evaluations of fuels and complete energy systems for electric power generation. His recent publications include articles on the effect of escalation on utility fuel costs, the long-range effects of cooling water regulations, design optimization of cooling systems, and analysis of future power generating capacity requirements, and a forecast of change in energy sources, and a forecast of energy utilization patterns. He is a registered professional engineer in Pennsylvania and has taken graduate studies at Syracuse University and the University of Pittsburgh. He was the founding chairman of the Atomic Applications Group of the National Electric Manufacturers Association. He's a member of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, the American Nuclear Society, the Atomic Industrial Forum, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, and the Solar Energy Society. It's a pleasure for me to introduce Mr. Lou Hauser, who will speak on the future trends in energy supply. Mr. Hauser.
You notice that rather lengthy resume had me working for a living back when I was in the divisions. It wasn't clear that today I'm in long-range planning, and we don't really have to work for a living in long-range planning. Instead, we observe the scene and we try to make projections. Today, I'd like to talk about the period of time between now and the year 2000. And you will notice as I make projections close to the year 2000, they become more positive than the ones I will make for just 2 or 3 years hence. I think the reason for that is that I expect to retire in 1984. Long-range planning is really, I recommend it as a profession, primarily because it takes them so long to find out you're wrong. But I'd like to talk a little bit about philosophy today and national energy policy and some views that we have on this matter, because I think it's a very serious one. People have said, and you've probably read, that what we need is a national energy policy. Really, we have one. We have always had a national energy policy. It may not have been the best one, but so far, the United States has been very successful. We have been a very prosperous nation, and we've made great strides in many endeavors. But our energy policy, until recently, had been to produce energy at the lowest direct cost. When you mined coal, you mined it at the lowest direct cost. You stripped the coal that was closest to the surface. You did nothing with the spoil banks because that kept the cost low. And that was a very satisfactory way to do it at that period of time because we needed low-cost energy in order to grow in other areas. But now that we start to use more and more energy, we find that we must consider the indirect costs of producing energy. We must now start to consider the effect on the environment, the effect on the social structures when we do these things, instead of taking just a straightforward engineering approach to it. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that, but one of the first things that I think we ought to look at is a projection of energy consumption. And I didn't make one. Instead, I'm using and really endorse the projections that were produced by the National Petroleum Council, and they published them in December of last year, on the need for energy in this nation. If I can get the first slide on there, I'll show you what that looks like. All right, now this shows the National Petroleum Council projection of energy growth rates. This is all energy consumed by the United States. And we have three growth rates there, the low one being 3.4% a year, and the maximum or high is 4.4. Now, you want to be careful with this slide because notice that it's plotted on semi-log. That curve is really going up a lot faster than it looks like when you're plotting something on a semi-log scale. They projected beyond out to the year 2000 and said they expected the consumption of energy by the U.S. population to continue to grow at some rate within this framework. The Department of the Interior, two gentlemen by the name of Dupree and West, did a similar study for the year 2000. And it's interesting. Now, they examined population habits, growth, general factors that are rather hard to define, but they did what we'd call a semi-social study on the consumption of energy. And surprising as it may seem, their predicted energy consumption for the year 2000 fell between the low curve and the medium curve of the National Petroleum Council. So the first point I'd like to leave with you is that it doesn't really matter when we're talking about this, about the precise growth rate of energy consumption. What's important is that the growth, the consumption of energy by the United States will continue to grow. It's not going to stop. It's not going to level off. It's going to grow. Now, if you accept that premise, then we must start to examine some of the problems associated with this. And one of the first ones is that we're running out of some of our readily accessible supplies of energy, and principally oil is one to consider. And people are starting to bemoan the fact that we're becoming dependent on the Mideast for oil, that our balance of payments, while they've been unfortunate recently, are going to get a lot worse as our demand for oil starts to grow and continue to grow. So I think one of the first things we ought to do is look at our energy reserves that we can produce within the United States. And I know you've seen lots of figures on reserves, but I've got a little different way to present it here. First of all, I'm using Q as a method of evaluation for a figure. Q is 10 to the 18th BTU. And we use, as you notice up there, the United States, our total consumption of energy in 1972 was 0.072 Q. Not very much. So now, if we look at what I call the producible reserves, I'm not talking about how much we have total in the ground. I'm talking about what could we conceivably get out of the ground in this time period, 1974 to the year 2000. So again, looking back at the National Petroleum Council, at their case two, and their case two was the case of a medium drilling rate and a high finding rate. In other words, they were going to be more lucky in finding gas or oil than they had been, but they were going to increase the number of drilling operations than they had been doing in the past. So if you use this and sum it for the period of these 26 years, we can produce 0.65 Q of natural gas domestically. Let me look up the exact figure and another figure for you on that. That's the same as 620 trillion cubic feet. Now, we're burning gas in this country right now at the rate of about 22 trillion cubic feet per year. So we could, if we put our mind to it, produce 620 trillion cubic feet domestically. If we do the same assumption for oil, domestic oil, the case two for the National Petroleum Council, comes out to be about the same amount of energy, and that's equivalent to 100 billion barrels of crude oil that we could produce in this period of time. This assumes that the North Slope will produce in 1976. That assumption is no longer valid because Congress still hasn't seen fit to pass the appropriate legislation to allow the pipeline to be built. But just assuming it isn't that much effect, it's 0.68 Q that we can produce both at a medium-high drilling rate and higher price for oil, which will allow for what they call the tertiary recovery of oil. You know, if you find 100 barrels of oil in the ground, you're lucky if you can get 35 barrels out by our present producing. The other 65 barrels stay down in the ground because we don't know how to get it out economically. If you raise the price of oil, that allows us to go down and do more work on that oil sand, we can produce some more oil out of what we've already found. So this 100 billion barrels includes tertiary recovery, which means that oil isn't going to be as cheap as it has been. It's going to cost more. But if it does, we can produce that much in this time frame. The National Petroleum Council said that there was 150 billion tons of coal that was well-plotted, economically recoverable. That's equivalent to 3.75 Q. Now, everyone knows that we have a lot more coal than that in the United States. Some people say as high as a trillion tons of coal. But just say 150 billion tons, that's a lot, because if you divide it by 25, that's an average of 6 billion tons a year if we were to mine it. And today we're mining coal at the rate of 600 million tons a year. So even if we mined coal at a rate 10 times our present rate, we would just use up that rather small reserve of coal over what we have totally available to us. And the fourth figure is uranium, U-308. And that's the energy that would be available in uranium that would cost twice as much as the current price today. Yellow cake today sells between $7 and $8 a pound. If we were to double that price to $15 a pound, we would have 1,600,000 tons of uranium available. If we processed that uranium and burned it in the present-day nuclear plants, we would produce 1.44 Q of energy. Okay, now that's a little different way to look at reserves. I'm saying in this time frame, this is what we can do domestically. Now let's look at this little chart, same scale up there, but look at the bottom part. That shows the percentage of energy that we consume supplied by each one of those four fuels. In other words, in 1960, we got 29% of our energy from natural gas, 44% from oil, 23% from coal, and essentially nothing from uranium in 1960. The only plant running then was Shippingport, and Yankee Road started up in December of that year. Now, if we look 12 years later, we see what's happening. We're using more natural gas as a percentage than we were in 1960. We're using more oil as a percentage than we were in 1960. We're using less coal, and we're hardly using any uranium at all. Now, therein lies the fallacy in the national energy policy that we have had and have been following. It's obviously not very prudent to use the most to increase the use of your least plentiful resource. We ought to be doing something else. We should be using more coal and more uranium and less oil and gas as a policy. Incidentally, the summation of the energy that we're going to consume if we follow that National Petroleum Council energy consumption pattern between 1974 and the year 2000 is 3.7 Q. We only used 0.072 in 1972, but we're growing at an exponential rate, and if you sum the area under that curve, it comes out to 3.7. We have enough coal to satisfy that. We obviously don't have enough gas or oil. To show that in a little better perspective, but before I leave this chart, there's one other point. A question was asked of the previous speaker about new types of generation and what can be done about them. Now, ponder this a moment. Nuclear power, until recently, has had a very favorable atmosphere or environment for development. There has been, some might disagree with me, but I'll say ample funds provided by the federal government to develop nuclear power. There have been large companies like my own that are very competent technically who have made tremendous commitments, not only of capital, but of personnel to develop nuclear power. We have utilities who have seen the advisability of buying nuclear power, buying tremendous quantities of it. So we have a new technology with almost everything favorable, and in a 12-year time span, we've only captured 1% of our energy consumption in 12 years. So when someone says, well, why don't we go to something else that's new, how fast can you change this energy consumption pattern if you have this kind of a track record to examine? Can you do it faster than we've been able to do it in nuclear power? And I seriously doubt it. I don't think that geothermal or tidal power or wind power or some of these other that are suggested today really have any place to consider in our future energy consumption in this time frame. Well, let's look at if we were to continue to use our energy consumption on the 1972 pattern. In other words, continue to supply 32% of our energy from natural gas, then we would see our supply that we could produce under very favorable conditions and our potential consumption exceeds that, so hence we have a shortage. This is already apparent to a lot of people around some parts of the country that we have a shortage of natural gas. Lots of it in the ground, we just can't produce it fast enough. If you look at oil, you'll see this very similar picture. This is just following the consumption pattern that we had in 1972. Then if you look at the other two that we have a lot of, you see that the consumption pattern of coal, we don't even begin to consume what we have available to us. And nuclear, we don't begin to consume what we could to produce. So this sort of tells us, I think, that there, very definitely we must make some changes in our total energy picture, and this must be done by means of a policy. We have to change our policy before these things are going to happen. Well, there's some other things to look at. Let's examine just a little bit the consumption patterns. Now, here's a 1968 Stanford research did a very extensive analysis of energy consumption for the United States, and I'm going to draw on their figures for this. But this first shows the prime sources of energy at the user level. And for example, under transportation, under vehicles, we use natural gas and oil as our prime source of energy at the user level. On process heat, we will use all forms of energy, the direct fuel as well as electricity. Industrial power, we use only electricity. You hardly see anything except an electric motor for industrial power. Same thing's true of lighting. Electric, people don't use candles or gas lights anymore very seriously. And also notice that 2% of our energy goes into lighting. Even if we turned out all the lights and never burned another one and went to bed with the chickens, you know, we'd only stop our energy growth 6 months until we're right back on schedule again. So lighting really isn't, turning out the lights isn't really the solution to our energy problem. You'll notice that space heating in homes, we use gas, oil, and electricity. Hardly anyone uses coal anymore. But in commercial and industrial, we use essentially no electricity for space heating. Well, if we go on and examine now where natural gas might be used, we see that chemical feedstocks, which is very important, used only 2.3% of our natural gas. The big fellows that use natural gas were process heat in industrial plants. That's a cost-sensitive fuel, because if you raise the price of natural gas too high, then industry will find another source of energy. Electric power generation, 17.8% of the natural gas went to that. And you notice in space heating of homes, we only use 16% of our natural gas. So you see there's a room here for some movement if we wanted to start following policies on how we're going to consume fuels. Take a look at oil. You see some of the same things happening there. Electric power generation in 1968 used 4.7% of the oil. That's gone up. I don't have a figure for 72, but I would suspect that that's gone up at least double in 72 because of the environmental regulations requiring utilities to move to oil from coal for power generation. Process heat doesn't use very much oil. Our big users of oil, of course, transportation, 53%. If you look at coal, you'll find about the only thing we use coal for, really, is electric power generation and process heat. Very little use of coal anyplace else. And then if you look at electricity, you'll find that we use very little electricity in process heat, quite a bit in industrial power. Very little in space heating of homes. Only 3.5% of our electricity goes into that factor. We use a lot in household and miscellaneous uses, and lighting uses 9% of our electricity. Well, this sort of tells you, sort of brings you up to date a little bit on how fuels have been used at the user level, not the producer end, but how they're really consumed by the user. So let's look ahead now at what sources of energy might be available to us before we discuss how we might use them. The ones on the left you've already seen on a previous chart, the four on the left, and those are what I call available because we now have the technology to utilize those fuels, and they are being used. If you look at the undeveloped ones, you've heard a lot about the oil shale that's out in Utah and Colorado and Wyoming. That's equal to about 1.5 Q. That's a lot, but it's really not tremendous. I have a question mark on geothermal because I'm sort of negative on that as being a viable economic source for very much energy. You'll find all types of projections on how much we could get from geothermal. The only thing I'm sure of is that if you go deep enough, it gets hot. But, you know, finding geothermal wells is really a problem. There's a lot of technical problems in utilizing the heat that comes out unless you have a nice superheated steam like Pacific Gas and Electric has at their geysers field. And as far as we know, the geysers is the only field available in the United States at this time. So I really put a question mark on geothermal, but the interesting one is solar energy, and that was discussed a little bit by the previous speaker. But the solar incidence on the land area of the 48 states, forget the other two, just the 48, runs about 50 Q a year. The trouble is it's very hard to capture, very difficult to utilize, but the energy source is there. And I agree with Sam when he says that we can't predict some of these things, but we surely should be looking at that source of energy because there must be some way, sometime, when the human race will be able to utilize that because it's a renewable, what we call a renewable resource. I've expressed it 50 Q per year because every year you get 50 Q. Then the other, the last one, is that same uranium that I have at 1.44 under the burner reactors, under the present-day reactors. If you take all the uranium that was mined to produce that 144 and process it in a breeder reactor, you produce about 100 Q of energy. So this slide right here, I think, tells you why it's an absolute necessity and why the government has already endorsed it, an absolute necessity that we develop, as a nation, the breeder reactor so we have access to that 100 Q of energy resource. Just to get a little pragmatic here, I have a fuel projection cost slide that I threw in. We do this type of work, and as you know, it's very difficult right now to project the cost of oil. And although we did at this time, it just shows you the difference between the low sulfur oil and the distillate fuel oil are up high, and they're probably going to go higher than I have on the chart. Now, you see, natural gas has been a regulated commodity for all intents and purposes. All interstate gas is regulated. It's been regulated at a real low price, presumably to protect the consumers. But if you recall back on the natural gas slide, 40-some percent of it goes to industry because it's been an economic fuel. It's been economic because it's been a regulated fuel with a low price. If you allow natural gas to float on a free market because it's a good fuel, a clean fuel, then the value of the gas goes up, then the use of it's likely to go down in some of the cost-sensitive areas. I've shown natural gas climbing at a very high rate. But the interesting things, the low-cost fuels are coal and nuclear. And then I have a little block down there on a breeder reactor. It's going to be someplace between 5 and 10 cents a million BTU for fuel in the breeder reactor. So this tells us, again, we ought to be using coal and nuclear. The problem is that if someone comes to you, if we have an allocation of energy, and they hand you a pound of yellowcake, uranium, and say, now this, sir, is your allocation to heat your home this winter, what are you going to do with it, you know? So really, we sort of get to the point where we ought to consider something like this. If we, instead of reading from the left to the right, read from the right to the left, start with the user. If you, in your home, have electric heat, for example, or if the factory uses electricity for its process heat, then from the user viewpoint, it doesn't make any difference whether we've made that electricity with solar energy, made it with coal or geothermal or whatever. So this is the one reason why I feel that the gasification of coal, for example, doesn't make much sense, because all we're doing is replacing coal into another form to add to a consumption pattern that is already outdated by the free market's status. Instead, why don't we change our consumption pattern so that we use electricity as the prime source at the user level? And if you do that, you come up with something like this. You know, No, where I have the yellow X's is where we would continue to use the fuel as we have. I'm not advocating electric cars now because that technology isn't developed. But we could run all of our trains on electricity. It doesn't really matter. We use only 1% of our energy on trains anyway. We will still use all the fossil fuels for chemical feedstock. We won't try to play games there. But we'll do all of our process heat with electricity. It can be done. That's the way we'll do it as a matter of policy. Of course, the industrial power is already electric. We will do all of our miscellaneous household and commercial uses of energy with electricity. See, none of you really need natural gas in your homes if your appliances are equipped to use electricity. The same way we will do all of our space heating with electricity, not with the other fuels. And if you do that, we then can have 70% of our energy consumption in the United States can be satisfied by electricity without the introduction of any new breakthroughs in technology, strictly as a matter of policy. Now, I paint that picture for you, and then you consider what you read in the newspapers today, where people are demanding moratoriums on the building of nuclear plants. Government leaders are telling you, use less electricity. New York State is pondering whether they should outlaw the use of electricity for space heating. All of these things don't seem to make much sense to me when I look at the total picture like this for the next 25 years. Thank you, and I'll try to answer any questions if we have any. Yes, sir.
Well, electricity is not a very efficient medium to use. Isn't that one of the reasons people are advocating things like
yes, that's right. And one thing about the efficient use of something, if you look at what we have available, and if you were to burn gas in your furnace in the home or burn it in a boiler and make electricity, the argument is you use less BTUs of gas in your home in there. But if you don't have gas, the question becomes academic, doesn't it? So then the question is, where do you get the BTUs? And if we have if we develop the breeder and have lots of BTUs in this time frame, then let's use those for heating of the homes, even if it is less efficient. But I won't even buy the efficiency story, because if you use a heat pump in most areas of the country, as far north as Pittsburgh, the heat pump is more efficient on a BTU basis than burning gas in a furnace or oil in a furnace, on a BTU basis, yeah. Yes?
The energy that we have left in the waste products in the nuclear stations that are in use now and will be in use until they get the technology on the bleeder station caught up, is this being put up in such a form that it can be utilized at a later date in a breeder reactor? Then we can get something.
Are you referring to plutonium? There's two types of things, really, I think, is the plutonium, which is a fissionable isotope, and which is normally used to fuel a breeder, and a lot of work has been done to use it less efficiently, but still use it in the burner reactor. So that's being done today, and economics sort of determines which way a utility will manage their plutonium. The second portion are the radioactive wastes, which are hot radioactively, and some of them are still hot thermally. And those, of course, have to be stored. We don't know any good use for them. So that's one of the indirect costs that have to be considered in nuclear power and are being considered. They have to be stored. Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hauser. Our next speaker is a graduate of Northeastern University, receiving a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering, and having taken graduate studies at Harvard Candidate School of Engineering, Graduate School of Engineering, and the University of Southern California. He joined the Atomic International Division of North American Rockwell Company in 1956, and has been engaged in the nuclear power industry since then. He joined Gulf General Atomics in July of 1972 in advanced systems engineering, and he's presently the director of the South Atlantic region for Gulf General Atomics. He is a member of the IEEE, the ASME, and the American Nuclear Society, and he's a registered professional engineer. He will talk to us this afternoon on the nuclear power and the energy crisis. It's a pleasure to present Mr. Philip R. Keefe of Gulf General Atomics. Mr. Keefe.
No one attending this symposium needs to be reminded that the U.S. is experiencing an energy crunch. Most of you are in the midst of struggling with increasing fuel demands, finding more resources, or improving the methods of recovering those we already have. Localized shortages of natural gas, gasoline, and fuel oil, as well as electric power restrictions involving interruptible industries and non-essential uses, indicate that the battle is not being won on all fronts. Although there is no immediate danger of completely depleting fossil fuel resources, we are already experiencing difficulty in meeting demands for environmentally acceptable fuels such as clean-burning natural gas and low-sulfur oil and coal. It has become quite clear in the light of forecasts of huge increases in energy use that we need alternative energy sources to ease some of the pressure on our valuable fossil fuel resources. To paraphrase Mr. B.R. Dorsey, Chief Executive Officer of Gulf Oil Corporation, competition in the future will not be between energy sources, as it has until recently. It will be for energy sources, clean energy sources of all types. The growth of overall energy use in the United States has been phenomenal, far outpacing the rapid population growth. Electrical energy demands are increasing more rapidly than demands for other types of energy and will constitute 40% of the total by the year 2000. It is in the production of electric power that alternative energy sources will make the greatest impact, immediate impact. For every 20,000 megawatts electric of alternative energy sources for electric power that can be brought online, 615,000 barrels of oil per day can be saved. This adds up to 5 billion barrels over the lifetime of the plants producing this capacity, which is equivalent to about 50% of the estimated oil reserves in the North Slope of Alaska. There is a growing consensus among those responsible for meeting our energy needs that nuclear power will play a much greater role in the U.S. energy economy. Naturally, I find this consensus quite agreeable, considering that nuclear reactors are Gulf General Atomics' principal product. It is my firm and hopefully not biased belief that nuclear energy is presently the only practical alternative source of electricity that would be both adequate and environmentally acceptable for meeting our future needs. But nuclear power will not appear instantly as though it was some technological genie standing by, ready to be summoned to help solve our energy and environmental problems. There are some very real problems ahead that will determine the rapidity with which we can bring the new energy sources to a point where they can significantly help in the years to come. Today, I want to present a brief overview of the status of nuclear power and its expected role in meeting the nation's energy requirements in the near future. I will also examine briefly some economic and environmental trade-offs between fossil-fired and nuclear plants. And finally, I want to outline the prospects of advanced nuclear systems, including a system where a nuclear source can be used directly in the generation of process heat to help increase our domestic supplies of gas and oil. Nuclear power plants are presently producing electricity on a commercial basis. Currently in the United States, there are 36 operable nuclear power plants with an aggregate generating capacity of about 21,000 megawatts. 56 other nuclear units with a total generating capacity of 51,000 megawatts are under construction, and 112 units now in the planning stage will add another 121,000 megawatts. In 1971 and 72 alone, a total of 57,000 megawatts of nuclear generating capacity was ordered by the utility industry, representing about 60% of all electrical generating capacity committed in this period. Nuclear capacity scheduled to date totals about 193,000 megawatts. For oil-fired plants, this equates to approximately 50 billion barrels of oil over the lifetime of plants providing that capacity. The commitment to nuclear power has been substantial because it is the most economical means of power generation in many areas of the country. It has a reliable and economic fuel supply. It is the best choice from the environmental point of view. And some utility systems have no alternative to nuclear power because environmental restrictions rule out the use of economical fossil fuels. Recently, the capital cost of nuclear power plants has increased significantly. Today's estimated cost of a 1,000 megawatt nuclear plant for operation in 1980 is about $400 per kilowatt. About 40% of this can be attributed to interest and escalation during construction. Other significant cost increases result from delayed construction, schedules, the imposition of more stringent operating and safety standards, changes in regulatory requirements, cooling water temperature restrictions, and escalating equipment and labor expenditures. Even though nuclear power presently represents a greater initial investment, it remains an attractive alternative because the capital cost of fossil plants has also been increasing for many of the same reasons. For example, it is estimated that systems to remove sulfur from stack gases of coal-fired generating plants if they can be made to perform properly, add $65 to $70 per kilowatt to the cost. Additionally, fossil fuel prices continue to rise. My first slide shows a projection of fuel cost in 1985. This will look quite familiar to one you saw before. Nuclear fuel currently costs about 20 cents per million BTU, whereas low sulfur oil costs about 95 cents per million. Coal and high sulfur oil are somewhat less expensive. Thus, even with capital costs that may be as much as $100 per kilowatt higher than for fossil fuels, nuclear plants are competitive because of their much lower fuel cost. Except for inflationary effects, future capital costs of nuclear plants should decrease because of economies inherent in standardization of components, advances in technology, and scale effects. Nuclear power has distinct environmental advantages. No combustion products that can lead to air pollution are created, and the problem of thermal discharges can be mitigated in a number of ways, as will be discussed later. The higher thermal efficiencies of the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor and breeder reactors decrease the thermal discharges that must be handled. These efficiencies are around 39 to 40%. Uranium ores are not expected to impose any constraints on projected nuclear fuel requirements at least until 1990 and could support a growth rate larger than presently predicted. The AEC currently projects that sufficient uranium ore resources are recoverable that costs up to $10 to $15 per pound of U308 concentrate to meet U.S. demands for uranium until breeder reactors become available. Breeder reactors will not only reduce uranium requirements, but will also make nuclear fuel costs less sensitive to increases in the price of uranium. The high-temperature gas-cooled reactor built by Gulf General Atomic will have a similar effect, since it uses a thorium cycle, and abundant thorium resources are more than adequate to meet projected needs. Estimates of near-term nuclear capacity are lower now than in some recent predictions because of delays currently being encountered in the installation of scheduled generating capacity. These delays are caused by late delivery of equipment, manufacturing quality control problems, construction problems, changes in regulatory requirements, and prolonged licensing procedures caused by intervention of nuclear critics. A period of 8 to 9 years is now considered necessary for bringing a newly ordered nuclear plant into operation. National Economic Research Associates recently assessed the near-term, that is 1970 to 1985, fuel supply and demand situation for the Edison Electric Institute. Their study projected the breakdown of fuel for electric generation as shown in the next slide. The anticipated rapid buildup in nuclear power generation will be further accelerated during the period 1985 through 2000 with the advent of nuclear breeders. Thus, nuclear energy is expected to supply a steadily increasing share of electric generation during the remainder of the century. Electric generation, in turn, will supply an increasing larger share of the United States energy requirements. Water-cooled and moderated reactors commonly known as light water reactors, represent most of the nuclear energy generating capability today. These nuclear plants have been quite successful and have operated safely and reliably. The LWR is now being supplemented by the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor, an advanced nuclear power system that has the advantages of higher thermal efficiency, resulting in less waste heat discharge to the environment, better fuel utilization, and significantly lower amounts of radioactive effluents. One of the encouraging aspects concerning the HTGR is its unique potential. Among the possibilities in advanced versions of this system are the direct cycle and process heat applications. Also, follow-on concepts such as the gas-cooled fast reactor and thermonuclear fusion reactor will use basic HTGR technology. Although most of the technological effort on the HTGR has been directed toward the development of the steam cycle, several programs are now underway to use this technology in more advanced systems, such as the direct cycle gas turbine HTGR. This system simplifies plant construction and results in capital cost savings. In the HTGR steam cycle system, the helium coolant serves only to transport heat from the core to the steam generators. In the gas turbine HTGR, it is also the working fluid for power conversion. Thus, all equipment related to steam generation and its use is eliminated in the gas turbine system. Dry air cooling as a solution to the problem of thermal discharge into natural water resources has not been used for large steam plants in the United States because of the high costs involved. This has been true even though dry air cooling has three main advantages: greater flexibility in the choice of sites, zero requirement for water makeup, and fewer secondary problems such as fogging and icing, which occur with evaporative systems. With the direct cycle nuclear gas turbine, however, dry air cooling offers an economical means of heat rejection. Building on demonstrated HTGR technology, the power industry can develop nuclear gas turbine plants before sites with ample cooling water become unavailable. The nuclear gas turbine with dry air cooling thus represents a significant step toward a more environmentally acceptable and economical means of power generation. The next slide dramatically illustrates the reduction in plant size and number of cooling towers required with the HTGR gas turbine using dry cooling. You see here with the lower efficiency steam cycle nuclear plants, about three cooling towers are required, and these cooling towers represent roughly, in terms of their size, the cost and capacity. The next level down is the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor, which, because of the higher efficiency, allows the use of less cooling tower capacity. And then at the bottom is the direct cycle using the gas turbine. And you see here that only two much smaller cooling towers are required. And you also see that the entire steam plant has been eliminated from the reactor plant. Thus far, our discussion has been restricted to the generation of electricity by advanced reactor concepts, primarily of the gas-cooled type. However, the reactor design and operating conditions of the HTGR can be readily adapted to deliver high-temperature process heat in the quantity and temperature range of interest for many applications. A helium core outlet temperature of 1450 degrees Fahrenheit is currently used for the power-generating high-temperature gas-cooled reactor. Temperatures up to 1650 degrees Fahrenheit appear to be attainable with modification to the method of fuel management or by more extensive orificing of the coolant channels. Improvement in fuel particles can further extend this range. Some of the more promising HTGR process heat applications requiring temperatures up to 1850 degrees include the gasification of coal to produce high BTU pipeline gas and the recovery of bitumen from tar sands. These process heat applications would directly alleviate the shortage of fossil fuels in the United States. A coal gasification plant incorporating a 3,000 megawatt HTGR would process 12 million tons of coal per year, producing some 630 million standard cubic feet of synthetic pipeline gas per day. An important application of nuclear process heat is in the extraction of huge quantities of petroleum from tar sands. In the large Canadian Athabasca deposit, there are enormous quantities of petroleum tightly locked in deposits of sand. In its present form of kerogen, the petroleum is semi-solid and cannot be extracted simply by drilling wells. At the present, it appears that destructive strip mining might be used to make these deposits available for processing. Heat is required to change this tightly bound kerogen to liquid hydrocarbons. We feel sure that nuclear process heat in the form of high-pressure steam will prove to be sufficiently economic to permit the process heat to be injected into the in situ solid rather than bringing the solid to the surface for exposure to heat. When this method becomes available, a great fuel resource estimated at about 700 billion barrels can be tapped with negligible impact on the topography of the land and with no need to dispose of tailings. A similar technique could be used for the recovery of ordinary crude oil, except that there would be a different balance between the steam needed for process and steam needed for electric power generation. This application is likely to be most attractive where there is a good synergism between the recovery operations and nearby utility operations. The fast breeder reactors, in which more fissionable material is produced than consumed, go a step further towards solving part of the energy crisis. In producing power, present-day light water reactors consume only 1 to 2% of the atoms in mined uranium. Breeders would be able to use 70 or 80%, thus extending the use of existing supplies of nuclear raw materials by about a factor of 40. They are expected, therefore, to surpass converter reactors in satisfying huge power demands of the future. Although major efforts have been directed toward the development of the liquid metal fast breeder reactor, there is currently keen interest in an alternative concept, the gas-cooled fast breeder reactor. The GCFR would require less development work than the LMFBR because it is not based on completely new technology. Technology of the nuclear steam and containment systems is but an extension of that already proven for the high-temperature gas-cooled converter. The fuel used would be essentially the same as that for the liquid metal fast breeder reactor. Based on extensive breeder development work to be done, the breeder could prove economically feasible within the next decade. The timetable for commercial availability is uncertain, but it is generally agreed that there will be competitive breeder plants in the United States by the late 1980s or 1990s. Now let us turn from the breeder reactor, which offers reasonable assurance of alleviating future fuel shortages, to a potentially far better energy source, the controlled thermonuclear fission of nuclei. This yet-to-be-developed concept promises a safer, more economical, and for all practical purposes, infinite source of cheap electric energy utilizing hydrogen isotopes from seawater as the basic fuel. Fusion may be the answer to many environmental problems as well. There will be essentially no radioactive waste from the deuterium-tritium fuel cycle, because radioactive tritium produced will in turn be used as fuel. The structural material will probably become highly radioactive and may have to be discarded periodically, but this consideration is minor compared with the disposal of fission reactor waste. Thermal efficiencies of first-generation fusion reactors will probably be about 40%, which is comparable to those of the most modern fossil fuel plants and the HTGRs. Later plants employing direct conversion devices may achieve thermal efficiencies up to 90%, thus potentially eliminating the problems connected with the discharge of waste heat to the environment. The inherent safety advantages of fusion reactors may also be economic advantages. The cost of transporting and storing radioactive waste will be low, and the reactors can be located virtually in the heart of population centers. Cutting power transmission costs and making waste energy available for district heating, refrigeration, and industrial applications. The AEC projects that the scientific feasibility of fusion may be demonstrated by 1980 or 1982 if present plasma containment and heating experiments are successful. The engineering feasibility of fusion reactors must then be proved through small test reactors and experimental power reactors to solve a number of difficult engineering problems. The AEC estimates that expenditures in the range of $1.2 to $2.5 billion are necessary to achieve this stage by the year 1990. The economic feasibility and commercial justification for fusion reactors could be demonstrated by the year 2000 through the construction of a 150-megawatt prototype reactor and a 500-megawatt demonstration plant. This optimistic schedule, with success assumed at all critical points, indicates that commercial fusion power cannot be counted on as an energy alternative until the first decade after the year 2000. It is evident that a long-range, vastly expanded research and development program will be necessary if fusion power is to become a reality. As a point of reference, the AEC is currently sponsoring fusion research programs at the rate of $60 million per year. In summary, then, a number of energy resources for electric power generation will probably coexist for many years. As in the past, the dominance of one source over another will gradually shift. Wood was the dominant fuel supply in the 1880s, giving way to coal by 1900. Coal, in turn, bowed to oil and natural gas in the 50s, which in turn are now yielding to light water nuclear reactors. Economic, environmental considerations will be prime factors in determining the rapidity and the direction of these shifts. Advanced converter reactors, such as the HTGR, now compete with existing sources. The steam cycle version will be followed by the gas turbine direct cycle system. Then the first generation fast breeder reactors will enter the picture. Fusion reactors should join the spectrum soon after the century. We in the industry see nuclear power as an ally of our fossil fuels to conserve them for more valuable uses, to assist in their efficient conversion to more convenient forms, and to gain access to previously inaccessible fossil fuel resources. We have then the opportunity at this time and the obligation to develop these nuclear energy sources and other clean and economical sources of energy available to us to ensure meeting future power requirements. Rewards for success will be great, a cleaner and more prosperous and safer world. The penalty for failure is intolerable, the deterioration of the quality of life on the earth. The action we now take will mark our place in history. We will be judged rather harshly, I'm sure, if we lack the initiative and vision to make full and timely use of this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker plans to explain what a fast breeder is and how the fast breeder development program stands at the present time. He's a graduate from North Carolina State University, receiving a Bachelor of Science degree in, of all things, civil engineering in 1961. And he graduated from North Carolina State University in 1970 with a Master of Science degree in materials engineering as a major and nuclear engineering as a minor. He was employed with the Tennessee Valley Authority and Hydraulic Laboratory during the period of 1961 to 1963. And from 1963 to 1969, he served as an officer in the U.S. Navy. He was selected for and completed the Navy's Nuclear Power School and subsequently qualified on the Navy's DIG prototype reactor. Johnny, you can tell us what a DIG is in a moment. And also the C-1W and C-2W nuclear propulsion plants as engineer officer of the watch. He served as boiler's officer on the USS Essex CVS-9. He joined the Duke Power Company in 1969 and presently is senior engineer in the nuclear group of the Mechanical Engineering Division of Design Engineering Department. He's a registered professional engineer in North and South Carolina, and is a member of the American Nuclear Society and presently secretary to the American Nuclear Society 21 Standards Committee. It's a pleasure for me to introduce Mr. Johnny Elliott, who will talk on the Fast Breeder Reactor Development Program. John?
Mr. Wilder, DIG is D1G, and it stands for a destroyer prototype, the first type constructed by General Electric. First of all, I'm very honored to participate in a program with such a distinguished group of speakers. But as Mr. Keep said, the previous speakers had softened his comments somewhat. Mine are getting downright soggy right now. I'd like to begin our discussion by asking a very basic question about the Fast Breeder Reactor Development Program. And that's why. Why should we have a breeder? In order to answer that question, I think we need to go back one more question, and why nuclear? And to do that, we need to look at the trilateral problem that's facing us today. First, the rapidly increasing demands for energy, the diminishing fossil fuel supplies, and the environmental considerations. And I submit to you that the nuclear does offer the best solution to the equation for the foreseeable future. Nuclear is one of the more economical means to produce power in many areas of our country. Nuclear has a reliable and an economical source of fuel, and it does have many of the better choices from an environmental standpoint. This is the third time you're going to see it, but I think you're going to see it. Did you load the secretary?
I'm loaded.
Sorry, all the way back to zero. Okay, thank you. You're going to see this slide, but what I want to demonstrate to you here is that nuclear costs are in the range of 20 cents per million BTUs, and its competitor, I guess, coal, was up in the range of 40 to 50 cents per million BTUs. Even though nuclear does represent a greater capital investment, the advantages of the fuel cost itself make it an attractive alternative. Now back to the question of why the breeder. In a speech in June 4, 1971, President Nixon made a statement, and I quote, "Our best hope today for meeting the nation's growing demand for economical, clean energy lies with a fast breeder reactor," end of quote. Although the AEC's predictions indicate that we will have adequate supplies of uranium ore to satisfy the United States' demands for many years to come, in order to fully realize the benefits of nuclear power, the fast breeder reactor must be developed. The effects of the breeder reactor, as indicated earlier, is phenomenal in that it will extend our uranium supplies by a factor of about 40. As indicated before, we presently in the light water reactors, we utilize about 1 to 2% of the uranium that's mined. With the breeder, we move up into the 70 to 80% utilization range. And this is in addition to the elimination of a very costly component of our fuel cycle process, and that is the enrichment cycle. Unlike some of the newer concepts for generating power, such as solar, geothermal, fusion, etc., the fast breeder's feasibility has been demonstrated. And the next step in the development of the fast breeder reactor is to demonstrate that the large commercial size units will provide dependable and economical power sources. To better understand our subject, let's briefly discuss the breeding process. Breeder reactors are similar in many respects to the light water reactors that we are building in many parts of the world today. But the breeders have a unique characteristic in that they produce more fissionable material than they consume. Fundamental to all nuclear reactors today is the fission process. In this process, the impact of a neutron upon a fissionable material will cause the atom to split or to fission, releasing the energy. In order to create this fissionable material, we utilize, in the breeder concept, a so-called fertile material. Now, this material is unique in that it will join with a neutron and combine to form a new fissionable material. And the fissionable material can, in turn, can produce more neutrons through its fissioning process and thus continue the fissioning process. Now that we've understand a little bit about the fissioning material and how it's produced, I'd like to look at one other basic fundamental rule of nature. That's concerning the number of neutrons that are emitted in the fission occurrence. The number of neutrons that are released per fission will vary with the isotope, but usually it will be greater than 2 neutrons per fission. Since only one neutron is needed to continue the fissioning process, neutrons in excess of 1 are available to interact with the fertile material to produce new fissionable material. Therefore, to be a candidate for the breeding process, the fissioning material must produce more than 2. And actually, in the practical application, it should produce considerably more than that, in that you have some non-productive absorption taking place in the process, which would not sustain your operation. Now that we've understand the breeding phenomenon, I'd like to describe the more popular types of breeders that you may see in the literature. There are the liquid metal fast breeder, the gas cool fast breeder, the molten salt breeder reactor, light water breeders, and steam cool breeders. As you might note, the name that's used to describe these processes indicate the type of coolant medium that's used in the process. Each has its own advantages and disadvantages in any given particular application. Of these concepts, there are 2 which seem to have the best chance to be early contenders for the commercial market or applications. First would be the liquid metal fast breeder reactor, which has received the strongest support in the United States to date. And the other concept would be the gas-cooled fast reactor. I will briefly describe some of the characteristics of each of these. Any given design will be peculiar to the manufacturer, I've selected the liquid metal fast breeder reactor demonstration plant and the gas-cooled fast reactor as my discussion models. Well, let me continue on here. There are 3 in the liquid metal fast breeder reactor. There will be 3 heat transfer loops associated with the reactor. There's a primary loop, an intermediate loop, and a power generation loop. The primary and intermediate loops will utilize sodium as its coolant, and the power generation loop will use the water steam coolant. One might ask at this point, why would sodium be chosen as a potential promising coolant for a fast breeder reactor, since we know that there are several known disadvantages to sodium, such as it has a chemical reaction with air and water. It becomes activated under irradiation. It's opaque and has a relatively high melting point. However, sodium does have some characteristics which are extremely desirable. It has excellent heat transfer properties, has low pumping power requirements, low system pressure requirements. It has the ability to absorb considerable amount of energy in an emergency, since it does operate at a considerable subcool condition. It has a tendency to maintain and hold fission products that might be released to the coolant, and it has favorable neutronic properties. And it also has an extended liquid range, in that it melts at about 210 degrees Fahrenheit and boils at about 1640 degrees Fahrenheit. The LMFBR concept was chosen over other concepts principally because of the predicted performance, the industrial support, and a broad base of technology, and a proven basic feasibility. The intermediate loop is a safety feature in the LMFBR in that it separates the radioactive sodium from the steam in the power generation loop. This slide gives the core plan. The center region constitutes the core zones. Moving outward, we find the blanket or the fertile region and the reflector zone, and finally the restraint assemblies in the outer perimeter. The core and the blanket assemblies are designed to give a breeding ratio in excess of about 1.2. The core is designed to achieve annual refuelings, with about 1/3 of the assemblies being replaced each year. Liquid sodium at 740 degrees and about 42.3 million pounds per hour flow in these inlets up through the core and out the outlet here. It divides into the parallel paths to cool the core, the radial blanket, the control assemblies, and the storage fuel assemblies in the vessel. There's orificing that's provided to properly distribute the flow and to limit the mid-wall fuel clad temperature to about 1200 degrees Fahrenheit. After passing through the core, the flow recombines at the outlet plenum and it exits at about 1000 degrees Fahrenheit. A free surface of the liquid sodium is under a argon cover gas. The core assemblies are a ceramic mixture of plutonium and depleted uranium oxides containing about 20% plutonium and about 80% uranium. The blanket itself is a depleted uranium oxide material, and the control rods are made of a boron carbide material. One piece of equipment that might be of interest to this group is the sodium pump. The pump is a single-stage centrifugal-type unit with an axial suction. Primary sodium pumps have the capability of about 34,000 gallons per minute. Capability to load follow and operation at partial power is afforded through a variable speed control of a 5-to-1 speed range hydraulic coupling to a 4,400 horsepower induction type drive motor. Normal pump speed is about 900 RPM, and the ability to continue operation under a power failure emergency condition is provided through a 250-volt DC power motor coupled to the pump and fed by a diesel emergency power system. The intermediate loops have a similar type pump, and their pumps are rated at about 22,000 gallons per minute. Now I'd like to move to the gas-cooled fast reactor and describe it very briefly. The gas-cooled fast reactor uses a helium as its cooling fuel, a fluid, to qualify for a satisfactory cooling fluid. Helium must be used at high pressure and must be moved through the core very rapidly. Since helium itself does not become radioactive or react chemically with water as does the sodium, the intermediate loop is not needed. The gas-cooled fast reactor will use the same basic fuel material concepts as would be used in the liquid metal fast reactor. Now that we have developed a basic understanding of the Breeder reactor and what it will mean to the future of nuclear power in our country, I would like to pursue the progress of the Breeder program to date. As a follow-on to the feasibility studies of the 50s and 60s, the next step in the Breeder development is to demonstrate the practicality and the economics of the concept. In this endeavor, the AEC selected a Commonwealth Edison TVA Tennessee Valley Authority proposal to build and operate the first demonstration plant. This proposal was submitted in January of 1972. The project was organized in March of 72, and the site was selected in August of 72. Manufacturers' participation was decided in late 72, and agreements between the parties was initiated in July of this year. In order to implement the LMFBR program, two organizations have been formed in the project management. The Breeder Reactor Corporation, called BRC on the slide here, is a 17-man board representing both investor-owned and consumer-owned utilities, the Edison Electric Institute, the American Public Power Association, and the National Rural Electric Cooperative. The Breeder Reactor Corporation provides senior counsel, manages financial contributions to the project, and serves as liaisons between the nation's utilities, and handles the dissemination of information. The Project Management Corporation, indicated as PMC, includes one representative from the BRC, or the Breeder Reactor Corporation, two from Tennessee Valley Authority, and one from Commonwealth Edison. The PMC will be responsible for the overall design, engineering, and construction of the plant. Commonwealth Edison has provided the project manager and the engineering manager. The TVA will start up and operate and maintain the demonstration plant. Westinghouse was selected as the lead reactor manufacturer. Burns & Rowe was selected as the architect engineer. And Atomics International and General Electric will share in the balance of plant. The LMFBR demonstration plant will be located on the Clinch River near Oak Ridge, Tennessee. The containment will be a right circular cylinder design of about 200 feet in diameter. And the basic containment design questions which remain open are the shape of the head as to whether it'll be ellipsoidal or hemispherical, materials of construction, whether it be steel or reinforced concrete, the size and configuration of the containment airlocks, location of airlocks, and the transfer corridors. After extensive studies, the arrangement of the primary and secondary heat transport systems is expected to be three identical primary heat transport loops. The primary loops will be have isolation valves for ease of maintenance and good accessibility. There will be an attempt to optimize the use and space and minimize the use of concrete. The capability to incorporate both the reference and the alternate design steam generator modules, as well as the arrangement flexibility for other components as the design progresses. It will have acceptable allowable piping stress levels, including appropriate accommodations for the severe thermal transients that it will see. It will use hot leg pumps, and it will also, primary piping sizes will vary from about 24 to 38 inches in diameter. I have a couple of slides that will show some of the plan and elevation views of equipment layout. I'll move through these rather quickly just to give you some appreciation for the architectural considerations in the plant. Here's some of the thermohydraulic design parameters for the demonstration plant. Note that the LMFBR will operate at a much higher temperature than our present-day burner-type reactors. This feature of high temperatures will create some very special problems for the designer, and such that many of the conventional materials will be severely limited, in some cases precluded from application in the LMFBR. At this point, I feel we should comment on the demonstration plant schedule. The LMFBR schedule presently calls for a 69-month period from award of contract to the fuel loading. Many people feel that this is a very optimistic schedule. However, this is the present objective. Although the gas-cooled fast reactor demonstration plant has not received as much support in the United States as the LMFBR, especially from the federal funding, the gas-cooled fast reactor does have a demonstration plant design which is presently being developed, and the gas-cooled concept is making some substantial advances and probably will be a strong contender for the fast reactor market. The gas-cooled fast reactor demonstration plant would draw heavily, as previously noted, on the experience from the HTGR design, and would utilize the pre-stressed concrete reactor vessel, the helium circulators, and the other features of the gas-cooled fast reactor will probably be extrapolations from the HTGR. The fuel utilized for the gas-cooled fast reactor will seek to use the experience gained in the LMFBR as its building block in its fuel technology. This slide outlines some of the target conditions for the gas-cooled fast reactor fuel program. Note that not only the high temperatures, but also high burn-ups must be carefully anticipated by the designer. These high exposures cause severe swelling of the fuel-clad materials and damage to the core structural materials due to a high neutron flux. This slide projects some of the design parameters one might expect in a 1,000-megawatt commercial-size reactor. In summary, the consensus of those who have studied and the available sources of energy production and the conversion is that in the relatively near term, say the next 50 years, the U.S. energy requirements must be met by the fossil fuel conventional plants, nuclear reactors operating on the light water principle, supplemented by the HTGR, high-temperature gas reactor, and the breeder reactor. Assuming that some newer energy production ideas such as thermonuclear fusion does, with some reasonable optimism, reach us in the year 2000, it would be at least the year 2020 before a substantial amount of our generation capability would come from these sources. As I stated earlier in my talk, I feel that in order to fully realize nuclear, we must see a timely development in the breeder. Thank you for your attention. Is there going to answer any questions? Yes, sir. No, it can be used in the breeder as well as in conventional. What you're breeding there is plutonium, and light water reactors today do have the capability for plutonium recycle. Most of them are planned on a self-generated scheme. However, plutonium is plutonium.
Most of the plan is that user basically go to 1% efficiency.
Yes, the plan would be to have, say, one breeder reactor and four light water reactors, at which the breeder would essentially be supporting the other light water reactors, as well as its own itself and its part of the power.
In order to get this energy, but no matter where I use it, I must extract the plutonium and remake a new.
Yes, you must take the plutonium out, recover it, and refabricate it into assemblies that are usable. Yes.
John, in that connection, in a light water reactor, what percent of the uranium fuel is converted to plutonium fuel?
How much? Let me ask you a question again. In other words, from a discharge of say of 30 metric tons, what would be the recovered?
Yeah, what would be the plutonium? Say you load a core and then you take the core out 3 years later.
Well, I would say we would recover 200 kilograms. It would be a ballpark figure. Maybe one of these gentlemen could on a given cycle. Keep in mind the light water reactors do some breeding on their own, in that they do utilize the plutonium late in life. But
well, what about the breeder? What about conversion? Was it all plutonium?
No. Well, the
plutonium. Yeah.
Yes, 20%.
80% depleted uranium.
Right, in the core region, and then the outer blanket is all depleted.
Right. That's been through a cycle of 3 years. How much is that just plutonium? You got any other
feel? No, I don't. I don't have a good feel for that percentages. Yes, sir.
Sort of control systems used to control grain fission.
The same basic concept that's used in a light water reactor is a poison inserted in the reactor. To terminate the fissioning process. You can think of these controls as being neutron sponges, if you like. And in the case of the breeder, they'll use a boron carbide, whereas in some of the light water reactors, they use boron, cadmium, different types of absorbing material. But the concept is the same. It's a
is it a temperature sensing that provides some feedback?
No, not necessarily. There's to get that insertion. You mean to get those insertion of that poison to the neutrons?
Primary measurements.
Well, there's several measurements. There's high temperature, low pressure, turbine trips. There's a lot of inputs that could cause a signal of an unsafe condition, which would cause the reactor to shut itself down or actuate the trip. Yes, sir. Type of moderator. Moderator?
Yeah.
In a breeder, you don't want to use a moderator because you want to use the fast spectrum. That's one of the reasons you use sodium, is because sodium has a very low moderating capability. In the light water reactor, we like to work with the thermal neutrons, which means we like to get these neutrons that are born fast energies down to a thermal energy before it's very receptive to a fissioning process. So in the light water concept, we use water because of the hydrogen atoms, proximity and the size to the neutron, which is a very good moderator, but in the fast breeder, you do not want that. You want to stay with the fast spectrum. Yes, sir?
Is there some problem with the fatigue of material in places that are inaccessible inside the reactor?
Fatigue?
Yes.
Well, yes, but probably no more that problem than any other problem. Are you thinking about fatigue from vibrations?
And heat.
Now, when you say heat, do you mean creep, or you really mean fatigue in the strictest sense? I associate fatigue with a vibration. Temperature may be a catalyst of sorts. I don't know.
I'm just thinking generally any process which reduces the strength of the structure.
Well, I think basically the problem in the breeder is the fact that you've got this high neutron flux available to your structural materials. If you're familiar with the high neutron flux, it does have considerable damage to the material. I won't try to go into the details of how this takes place, but basically you get a breakdown within the molecular structure of your material due to this fast neutron bombardment, and you get essentially an embrittlement. Or you may be familiar with the Neal ductility transition temperature that people speak about in many materials. When you get this thing shifting, getting lower, then you run the risk of brittle fracture. But to answer your question, fatigue, creep, swelling, all these are problems that must be taken into account by the designer. And I wouldn't put fatigue any in any higher place than the other aspects.
John, is that connection right with you? Coupon safe?
Yes, that's a good point. In these reactors, the light water reactors today, and I'm assuming the fast reactors in the future, they do put in, like the, one of the critical components would be the reactor vessel itself, which is very close to this high flux area. They do take sections of material from various heats that are used to build up this, to make this reactor vessel. And these are placed in the reactor and are taken out periodically, like at the end of the first year, the fifth year, seventh, tenth, 30th year. They take these samples out and subject them to some destructive type tests to try to evaluate what's taking place from the materials damage standpoint in the reactor with regard to needle ductility, transistor temperature, and some other aspects of that's critical to a material. So we do put these samples in that are actually from the heats that we use to make the vessel, and then we take them out periodically and test them to try to get an idea of what's going on inside. Yes, sir.
I understand that the power companies are now making a contribution to a new research effort, which is going to be set up, I believe, out in Stanford or in that area. This is going to be looking at new possible sources of energy. Is the nuclear breeder reactor one of these, or are you depending on the AEC and its concerns with this?
Well, to answer your question, the utilities are participating in and supporting financially, as well as personnel-wise, the development of the liquid metal fast breeder reactor. Utilities do participate in a lot of research programs, normally through the Edison Electric Institute, which is a sort of a, rather than having 15 different utilities carrying on 15 different research programs by channeling their funds into a central operation, hopefully we get more results out of our money by doing that. We can concentrate our efforts in a more
proper research for you.
I don't know. I can't answer your question. It's done at various places. I guess the Edison Electric Institute channels these funds.
John, actually, in the past breeder reactor program, there was something like 90 utilities.
Yes, in that group that I read off there, there's a significant number. I don't know the number, but this program is talking like $560 million, I think, of which a couple hundred million of that is shared by the utility groups and the manufacturers are contributing, and of course the AEC is contributing. It's a big joint cooperative program in this demonstration plant that will be built at Oak Ridge. Any other questions? Thank you very much.